Taiwan, Washington. Hello again from the nation's capital. I'm Greg Corumbus. In this edition, Founding Faith. Author Stephen Walden is with us to talk about what the founders really meant and thought when it came to religious freedom. What does the freedom of religion mean in the First Amendment to our Constitution? What did they really think about a separation of church and state? And what was the beliefs in their own personal lives? Also in this edition of Dateline Washington, the confrontation. Our friend and longtime terrorism expert, Dr. Waleed Faris, is with us with the third in his installment of three books explaining how to confront our enemies and win the war on terror. What is the key to defeating this radical enemy, and are we on the right course? Plus, tackling crime. We'll talk with Ron Ricker, president of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, about why he wants a special commission appointed by the next president to deal with the issue of rising crime rates in this country. All of that, plus a look at the day's top stories is still ahead in this edition of Dateline Washington. We begin with a look at the faith of our founders, and we begin right now. The role of faith in public life remains a vigorous topic of debate in this country. But it turns out it's been a vigorous topic of debate since the founding of the country. Our toned-down history books sometimes paint the founders all marching in lockstep on all the important issues. But that's not the case, and the intertwining of faith and public service drew very different reactions from the most famous names from the American founding era as well. With me now to discuss that aspect of the founding era is Stephen Waldman, author of Founding Faith, Providence Politics, and the Birth of Religious Freedom in America. He's also the co-founder of BeliefNet.com. And Stephen, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
What drew you to research this topic so thoroughly and eventually write a book about it?
I kept getting, every day I would get an email from someone from a different advocacy group, left or right, quoting a founding father to prove something, usually the complete opposite thing of what I'd gotten from them the day before. People were just cherry-picking Founding Fathers quotes, and I thought, surely there's some distortion going on here, and I wanted to really figure out what happened, both in terms of what were their actual religious beliefs, but even more important, how did we end up with religious freedom? It's such an important achievement of the American way. How did it actually happen? I had the sense that the culture wars had really completely distorted how we ended up with religious freedom.
And to briefly go ahead and talk about that, obviously there was Puritans coming who were upset with the Church of England. They formed the Massachusetts Bay Colony and so forth. But how much of an issue was that in the whole migration over to the New World as it was known and eventually once the independence movement got going?
The first 150 years really were a series of experiments in establishing Christian states. It wasn't entirely in every state, but for the most part, most of the states in New England and in the South, attempted to have Christian states. It was part of the law. There were official established churches. The taxes were collected to help pay for ministers' salaries and churches. And so if the question is, was the land settled as a Christian land, the answer is yes. And as a Protestant land, it should even be more specific, because in many cases it was very much in a point of an antagonism to Catholics. When we got to the revolutionary period, the founders basically looked at this first 150 years of experimentation with this approach and concluded it hadn't really worked that well. Basically said, although they agreed with the motive of encouraging religion, the goal, they said that it really hadn't worked that well and that they needed to take a very different approach. And so they came up with the what was then quite a radical idea, that the best way to encourage religion is to leave it alone, have the government get out of the way, and which is quite a departure at that point.
Was that largely a result of them seeing that the states and the colonies prior to the independence movement had problems, or was it because there were different faith traditions, Puritans in New England, and then Pennsylvania Dutch, and then Anglicans down in Virginia?
It was both. You had the experiences going on, like, for instance, in Virginia, one of the accidents of history that turned out to be quite important was that there was a tremendous wave of persecution against Baptists in the 1770s, right in the part of Virginia that gave us James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, George Washington. So there was quite a vivid, direct experience with what happens when the power of the state is allied with a particular denomination. But then also, as you said, When George Washington was leading the Continental Army and was essentially running a national institution, he had Catholics in his troops, he had Congregationalists, he had Baptists, he had all sorts of things, and he had to suddenly look at this from a very different perspective of how do we create a kind of a sense of broad religiousness, but which includes the full range of religious diversity. We don't think of it as being a particularly diverse time now because they were all Protestant, but to them, there were huge differences between the Protestant dominant denominations and certainly with Catholics.
And Stephen, one of the things you do in this book is kind of look at the writings and thinking of five of the most famous of the founding personalities. Let's talk about them for a little bit and see how they the reality of their writings and their time contrasts with the public perception over the many years. Let's start with George Washington, who many believe is probably the most devout of these five people. What do we learn about him by studying him closely?
Well, we learn that he probably doesn't fit exactly the script written for him by either left or right. He probably was the most devout, and you can see it in frequent letters and public proclamations where he ascribes outcomes to God's intervention. He really thought that given the pathetic nature of the troops and the overwhelming strength that Britain had, that it really was only from God's intervention that we won the Revolutionary War. He thought his own life had been saved that way. He continued to use language like that once he was president. On the other hand, he refused to take communion when he went to church, and a point that was not lost on the ministers at his church, who were very upset about it because they thought if George Washington is not taking communion, what kind of model is that for everyone else? So I think he was very religious, very spiritual, very prayerful, but he also had problems with some of the rituals of the church of his day.
Two other founding fathers that a lot of people, and according to your book, kind of naively think of simply as deists were the Franklin and Jefferson types, who you mentioned Jefferson described himself as a heretic. Where is the conventional wisdom right? Where is the conventional wisdom wrong there?
I argue that none of them were actually deists, which is a little bit controversial. But to define deism, I think the proper definition is someone who believes that God created the laws of the universe, but then sort of receded from the action and wasn't involved in any personal level in people's lives or in history. And so the reason I don't think that even Jefferson and Franklin, who certainly come the closest to being deists, really weren't, is that they did seem to believe that God intervened in history, in the course of America's history, and in their own lives, at least at certain points in their life. So I think they really weren't pure deists.
Another one on the list is James Madison, who of course is known as the father of the Constitution, and you talk about in the book, and you've also talked about it a little bit here in our interview, that one of the ideas behind the First Amendment most likely was that they just wanted government out of religion entirely, more for the benefit of religion than for the benefit of government, correct?
Yeah, and there was a really interesting subtle difference between Jefferson and Madison on this. Jefferson actually seemed to be more concerned about the effect of religion on government. He was so angry at what he called the priestcraft, and thought they would just mess up the government. Madison looked at it more from the other direction, of the involvement of government hurting religion. And to me, one of the most interesting and little-known aspects of this whole story is the alliance between Madison and the evangelical Christians of his day, the 18th century Baptists. They were closely allied, as was Jefferson, with this fight for religious freedom. And they ended up being, you know, Madison was really probably even more of a strict separationist than Jefferson was, but for completely different reasons. He really thought it was going to be the best thing for religion to get government as far away from it as possible.
And Stephen, of course, the First Amendment, there's been a lot of controversy over that in recent years and quite throughout the history of the country. First of all, the Establishment Clause, and then, of course, there's the Free Exercise Clause. As you go through the writings of Madison and some of the others in that era, what exactly did they mean by those phrases?
Well, first you want to just kind of reach back in time and, you know, slap them and say, couldn't you have been more clear, given how much time we've spent in the last 200 years trying to figure out what they meant? And part of why they weren't clear is that there was not a consensus about it. And to some degree, they were like politicians we have now. When you have a disagreement, you put some vagueness in and kick the problem down the road. So what we do know is that at the time of the founding, first and most importantly, that they were talking about the national government, not the states. And there's this fascinating moment during the debate when Representative Sylvester from New York says that he's afraid the First Amendment is going to abolish religion. Thinking like, what? You know, this is the great protector of religion. How could it abolish religion? Well, the reason is he thought that by having a clause on the national level that knocked out religious establishments, that it would also knock out the religious establishments in the states, which still existed. They had them in Massachusetts and Connecticut, a number of other places. So Madison had to, in what was probably a kind of uncomfortable moment for him, say, don't worry about it. This only applies to the national government. The states can continue to do whatever they want, which, you know, it's amazing. At that moment, 11 of the 13 colonies still had religious tests that said Catholics or Jews or Unitarians couldn't serve in public office. And that was all still allowed to stand, even by the First Amendment. So it wasn't until, you know, after the Civil War, when those things started to get applied to the states. Now, within the, you know, so what does that mean? What does the word establishment of religion mean? And here, unfortunately, there's a lot of debate even among the people at that time. Madison really felt that it was not just a matter of an official state church. Madison defined that word to include even well-meaning efforts to help religion. Other people said, no, it's just about an official state church. And, you know, so that's the part that where they kind of bequeath to us a certain amount of ambiguity.
Stephen, unfortunately, our time is up. Sir, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stephen Waldman, author of Founding Faith, Providence, Politics, and the Birth of Religious Freedom in America. He's also the co-founder of BeliefNet.com. This is Dateline Washington.